The views expressed in this interview are those of the individuals and do not reflect the official policy or position of the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Navy, or the Naval Postgraduate School.
Welcome to the Trident Room, brewer of stout conversation, unfiltered and on tap. On today's episode, host Colleen Willington, Daniel Peterson, and Elena Youngblood sit down with Captain Heather Quillenderino as commanding officer of the Naval Oceanographic Operations Command and discuss her METOC experience and how the U.S. Navy utilizes the Nook.
Good afternoon from the Naval Postgraduate School campus in Monterey. Your hosts today are Lieutenant Commander Colleen Wilmington, Lieutenant Commander Alana Youngblood, Lieutenant Daniel Peterson, all meteorology and oceanography METOC students at NPS. We're honored to have with us today NPS Meteorology and Oceanography graduate, the commanding officer of Naval Oceanography Operations Command, NOOC, Captain Heather Quillenderino. Thank you for taking time out of your schedule to discuss the METOC community, your command, and your personal experience throughout your military service. We'd like to spend some time getting to know you and your experience throughout your naval service, and then discuss your leadership and vision of the METOC community in the future. Could you share a bit about your personal and professional background leading up to your current roles and how you got here?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I started out as a surface warfare officer, graduating from University of South Carolina from the ROTC program, and started off on USS Port Royal out of Hawaii. So I got to attend the long version of SWAS, which was wonderful, and then head out to Hawaii. I always knew that I wanted to work in oceanography, so I came in with the ocean option, and at the end of my first tour, laterally transferred to the oceanography community, and then have had an incredibly diverse career since then, which is one of the things I love about our community and tell a lot of the new officers coming in is don't look at a slide to see what your career is going to look like, because I've never met two METOC officers with the same thing. So I showed up at Fleet Survey Team in Stennis, Mississippi, and was immediately told to go across the street. We're going to start up this new ASW reachback cell. And I had ASW experience from my previous tour. And so I went over there, and at the time we were supporting ASW exercises by bringing people in TAD to stay on the watch and then go away. We didn't have any other billets filled. So I stood up the ASW reachback cell, which then eventually became part of Naval Oceanography ASW Center Stennis when we stood up the command in 2006, I think. And so became a plank owner of that command and then was selected to attend the MIT HUI joint program in oceanography for my master's. And so I went up there and had a phenomenal time while trying to keep my head above water, because it was one of the hardest things I've ever done. And did not realize that I was going to attempt a graduate degree at MIT anytime previously in my life. And so it was a little challenging, but I had a phenomenal time there, worked with some really incredible individuals, and particularly studying underwater acoustics and the environmental variability of acoustic propagation. And then was selected for the PhD program while I was at MIT.
Very nice.
And except in meteorology. So a little bit of a curveball. I showed up here and sat down with the MR department chair and said, just so we're clear, I've never taken a class in meteorology before, right? So I was essentially starting from scratch and had my 3 years here. I'd worked in air-sea interaction and boundary layer dynamics. So it was the perfect kind of meshing of my new meteorology knowledge and my history of oceanography and acoustics.
Out of curiosity, who was your advisor?
Ching Wong.
Ah, yeah.
So, which was amazing. She was incredibly supportive, both within my academic studies here at NPS and then also just by the benefit of being a student here, I got to participate in several different research projects and be out in the field working with hurricane hunters, both the Air Force C-130 hurricane hunters, the 53rd Weather Squadron, as well as one of the NOAA P-3s in our Madden-Julian Oscillation research project out of Diego Garcia.
I'm only jealous.
It really was an excellent opportunity, and I got to participate in a couple as well when I was at the MIT HUI program. So lots of research time in the field, which was incredible. Something that I think not that many Navy people get a chance to do, and more METOC folks should take advantage of while they're here. I know a lot of people do. And so then from here, I went and I was the first staff METOC officer for Naval Special Warfare Group 10. And so that was eye-opening to work in an entirely different field, entirely different community. I was at Group 10 when the announcement for the lifting of the combat exclusion for women came up and the order to integrate BUDS. So that also led to some interesting and unique conversations, as I'm sure you can imagine. From there, I kind of got back on track in more of a traditional, I guess you could call it, career path. I went to Carrier Strike Group 10 for my 04 milestone and did a deployment on the Ike. And then from there, I went to become the operations officer for Fleet Weather Center Norfolk, where I met Dan. And we worked together. And then Naval Ice Center as 05 CO, where I met Colleen. And, well, I think I got there a few months ahead of her. But took command of the Naval Ice Center and directorship of the National Ice Center in 2018. Was lucky enough to have almost 3 years in 05 command, which was amazing. And then I did some time in the Pentagon, serving my time in the N2 and 6 front office for Vice Admiral Tressler, which was eye-opening and an incredible experience. And then from there, came directly down to Stennis Space Center to take command of Nook. So that brings us to today.
Quite a journey.
Yeah, I always find it fascinating. You know, Captain kind of hit on it, that you never come across two METOC officers with the same background, because there's such a diversity and an opportunity for us in the METOC community. So we get to touch a lot of different warfare areas, and it gives a lot of insight into the way that we support that. So, yeah, it's really awesome.
Jumping a little bit in our plan, how has your family shaped your military service, your PCS moves, or has military service kind of shaped your family moves?
Well, it's interesting because things have been dynamic for us in the past few years. So I did the first 10 years of my career single. I would say I did not grow up as a necessarily military family, so I didn't know that this was going to be my life service. My grandfather retired from the Army after 28 years, but was retired well before I came along. So while I knew of some of his stories, it was not necessarily following in his footsteps, though he certainly had a hand in the fact that I finally decided to at least try it out. And then, so it was really easy for me to move around, to go to school, to do all of these things, you know, when I was single. Certainly at that time I was enjoying moving around and getting to live in different unique places. I'm a huge lover of history, so living outside of Boston is amazing. And had some really great experiences. I actually met my husband when I was here as a student at MPS. He was a surface warfare officer and was in the systems engineering and analysis curriculum. And so we met here, and then immediately were bi-coastal when he went to department head school. So the first 18 months of our relationship was long distance. I'm trying to manage between me finishing my dissertation and him going through department head school, and then hopefully we would end up on the same coast. We did about 8 years of dual military, where we had several back-to-back deployments. One deployment where we literally crossed in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Our CPA was 15 miles, closest we'd been in months, heading opposite directions. So pretty much the definition of a dual military marriage right there. He decided to retire in 2020. And so since then, I've sort of seen how the other, I won't say the other half lives, but while I thought I was empathetic to folks who have civilian spouses that get ripped out of their careers and have to restart and things like that, I certainly found the challenges to be much different than when I was dual military, where we're working with the detailers and trying to get COLO. And, you know, sometimes we succeeded at COLO, but our deployment schedules weren't supportive. And then as a civilian, you know, we had been in DC for about 4 years. He retired from the Navy. He started his second career. He was about 18 months in and absolutely crushing it. And I said, oh, by the way, I just found out we're leaving in 3 months, when I had orders to stay. So I, you know, kind of my understanding and empathy, I think, has grown. I have been extremely beneficial, though, in finding a spouse who, after his decision to retire, is incredibly supportive of picking up and going wherever the Navy needs to send me. And, you know, we had an inkling that I was going to get pulled off the bench for major command. And on that car ride home, he said, whatever they offer you, take it, we'll figure it out. And so from a family perspective, I feel incredibly fortunate that I have someone who is so 100% supportive in my corner, you know, willing to sacrifice to move around with me. And while we don't have children, we're still feeling the slog of moving every 2 to 3 years or four, you know, depending on how lucky you are at getting some back-to-back tours. So I know that that's something that a lot of people think about, especially those with young children, and they're looking at ahead and where are the kids going to be. And, you know, we don't maybe have the same focus, but we're still thinking about that too. And, you know, we're ready to settle down and put down roots and stop picking a new house every 2 years and things like that. So we have some of those same kind of personal issues that we go through, and we've thought about it, you know, even at this point too. But at this point in the career, he and I have talked about what our end state goals may be, and, you know, he's all in. And even, you know, Emerald Perrette has sat down with me and said, have you talked to Johnny about what your goals are, you know, because this is a two, you know, two person or more, right? Your whole family has to be behind your career. Yeah, and I said, yes, sir, he's all in. We know we have a plan for however long the Navy would like me to serve. And I'm thankful to have that. But it is also a challenge, I guess, reworded, I would say. It's helpful to have a spouse who is either staying home with kids or working from the home or has some sort of remote job or job that can easily transfer to another area. And I understand that there's so many sacrifices when somebody's not in that field that they basically just pause and put things on hold, and it's really challenging. So just say, if you have someone that's supportive, then it's great to have that kind of support at home.
I think that's one of the unique things that happened during COVID is a lot of a lot of jobs got moved to being at home jobs or remote working, and I know that was an opportunity that was afforded to my wife to be able to do that remotely, and she works in San Diego, but we're up in Monterey, and so having the ability to do that has been huge because this is the longest that she's been able to sustain a single job throughout my entire military career. So definitely can appreciate the challenges that come from that, and having a supportive network at home is crucial to our success in being able to operate and do what we need to do. So Johnny's my hero.
Yeah, I think it's gonna be like super interesting 10 years from now to reanalyze how COVID not only changed basically the way that we operate throughout our entire lives and throughout the world, but like how that transition shifted for the spousal support or military support, or like what that meant for being mobile for the families. It'd be interesting to look at, I think.
I also think one of the biggest things that Congress has done to support that is as we've put things into place to help increase the ability for license transfers,
yes,
across state lines, and then the reimbursement when they do have to do some sort of relicensure exam or mm-hmm. certification. I think those are big steps to helping support it. And some of my JOs who have recently gotten married are looking at that, you know, didn't really see that part of it yet. And so being able to share that with them, and these are ways that you can help support your spouse because of the things that have been put
into
place.
That's a really great reminder and point.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that's kind of the untold story in this. You know, when I first joined the military, my wife had to move her college from University of North Florida to Old Dominion, and the military paid for her degree at the end of the day because of that move. And so, you know, we walked away both with education without having to pay for it, which is huge because, you know, a lot of people today are trying to tackle that student debt problem set. Mm-hmm. So the military provides a lot of different opportunities out there for both military members and spouses.
Ma'am, in your diverse roles that you've gone over, have there been any situations or challenges that have broadened your perspective on MeTalk?
Broadened my perspective on MeTalk? In what way?
Difficult situations or like different weather phenomenon, or like you mentioned, integration of other services. You mentioned some empathy and emotional leadership.
So I would say, because certainly a broad question, which is why I kind of asked you to narrow it down, because if we're talking from, you know, a science and technology standpoint, I think being at sea as a MeTalk is one of the absolute best things that we can do. I loved my sea tour when I was a surface warfare officer, and I am not one that says, you know, oh, I couldn't wait to leave the SWO community. I actually loved it. I had a great experience. But as I mentioned, I've always wanted to do oceanography. And so there was no way that I was going to turn down the opportunity to come into the oceanography community. And so being at sea when I was on the carrier strike group, I think what maybe broaden the impact of what we do is really having leadership that trusts in the abilities of my team and of me to be able to communicate our forecast to them in a way that they can make risk decisions and have faith in what I am offering to them in terms of decision space. And there's an example that I used to tell all the time that's exceptionally relevant today because now we're very focused in the BAM again and back in the Southern Red Sea. When I was deployed on Ike was the last time that we saw, and really it was the first time in a while that we had seen increased tensions to the level where there were missiles being shot at ships. And I had the opportunity, based on my team's forecast, to actually move the entire strike group transit up 24 hours, which is incredibly unusual, right? You might have a chance to push it back, but trying to get that much momentum to move things forward 24 hours is pretty significant. But when it comes to, you know, safe operations and safety of the personnel on board, I had 100% confidence from my strike group admiral at the time, who called the fleet admiral and said, this is what we want to do. We got permission, forecast verified, most importantly. Everyone was safe, also important. And, you know, we were able to conduct a safe transit. That was towards the end of my deployment, so I certainly had many other examples, but I feel like that one resonates from just a safety, like the baseline fundamentals of what we do as METOC professionals, our sailors, and everyone that's learning to hone their skills here at MPS. But, you know, providing that foundational safety to ensure that our people are able to operate safely, and then follow that on with ensuring, you know, mission capability, mission accomplishment. I have had the chance to work across the services primarily, well, two examples that I can think of. One, primarily with Air Force folks, and that was part of what I was doing when I was working with the hurricane hunters. Different services just have very different cultures. You know, I think that is not necessarily METOC specific, but kind of understanding the Air Force culture. And then the other opportunity was when we were at the ICE Center together and we were working with NOAA and Coast Guard, because it's a tri-service agency and they all operate exceptionally differently. And trying to mesh all of those different cultures together to form a unified team is incredibly challenging, but when it works, when you get to see kind of the fruit of all of that, it's incredibly rewarding too.
So, I mean, that's a lot of incredible, various, just great examples and experiences. I mean, just in a very short, compact time frame. I think that, you know, one of the questions in the back of my mind is, you know, as you're the commanding officer of the Nook, is how have those experiences lended to your inputs at the Nook, and what exactly is the Nook doing to help support those different functional areas and support the warfighter? How does that integrate?
So the Nook, really, we can look at from two aspects. The first is that it is home to the Reachback Center for the METOC community, providing support primarily for USW and EMW, so ASW and mine warfare under the USW envelope, and then electromagnetic maneuver warfare, as we have added that mission set over the last 5 years. And so that is one of our primary missions. And then as ISIC, we also have the Naval Oceanography Special Warfare Center and the Naval Oceanography Mine Warfare Center. And so those are also very specific warfare areas that we're supporting. So from a Reachback Center perspective, I think there's a couple things. One, we have a watch floor full of fleet returnees. So everyone, all of my sailors that are standing watch on the watch floor doing USW and EMW have been out deployed at some point. They understand why what they're doing is important, but reminding them of why what they're doing is important is my job. Because anytime you're sitting on a watch floor, you're doing the same thing day after day, you're living that grind, it's easy to forget why what you're doing is important. So that's part of it, bringing those examples in. And we have a lot of visitors come through the command, and we've had some great folks that remind my sailors of how they took those products and it helped, you know, keep the submarine safe or helped them execute a mission. And then, so that's one piece of it. And we're supporting the warfighter by trying to make sure that we are providing succinct products that help explain the environmental picture. we have incredible AGs that are out on the big decks that are, you know, supporting via ESCOTs and METs, but not all the warfighters have embedded AGs. And so I look at it as Nook's mission to support all of the warfighters out there who don't have embedded AGs. And certainly we still are supporting our own internal family when they're out there so that they can do the best job they can. But if you look at the individual deployers or you look at the fleet staffs who maybe have a fleet oceanographer and one AG or two AGs, or they're trying to do it on their own, we're here for them to help them communicate the environment to those particular decision makers, be it the ship CO or the fleet admiral, so that they can understand the battle space. So that's from sort of the Nook headquarters perspective and looking at their reach back center. Certainly from Namwick and Noswick, those teams, when they're deployed, are right in the midst of everything and understand the impact of what they're doing because they are right there alongside the folks that they're supporting, right? Our METOC forecasters are deploying with the SEAL teams. They're right there embedded and living the same forecast every day along with the teams. And then our Namwick folks in Namwick has recently expanded its mission set from mine warfare, maritime homeland defense, to include littoral hydrographic survey. So with the sunsetting of fleet survey team, Namwick has assumed quite a bit of that mission from the command. And so they're really honing their skills in hydrography and seabed sensing so that they can provide that across the globe, wherever it's needed.
I think those are great points. You know, standing as a person who sat out on watch floor, I think one of the things people may not fully appreciate is the feedback. When you're out operationally deployed with the decision makers, feedback's instantaneous, both positive and negative. Well, mostly negative, but occasionally you get positive feedback. So, you know, it's easy in those watch floor situations to kind of lose focus in the sense of what you're doing is important because you don't have that registered feedback on a regular basis. And then flipping hats and being on the other side as a staff oceanographer, alone and unafraid with no support, it's just me, you know, knowing that I had that team back at the Nook that I could depend on, that I could reach back to for just about any question under the sun, and having that support system was hugely beneficial in enabling me to be able to get the work done I needed to do because I'm only one person. There's only 24 hours a day and I'm pulled 8 different directions. So having that reach back capability and knowing that support was there, I mean, it's hugely enabling to the force. So I can speak to both ends of understanding that dynamic. It's very awesome.
Ma'am, you talked about changing responsibilities for some of our commands. Are there some emerging technologies or trends that you think will positively impact the Nook's future that you could let us in on?
Sure. So it's interesting that we talk about technology and innovation so much. And, you know, it's certainly something that I think is exceptionally important, especially as scientists, as a very science-driven community. We always want to be on the cutting edge and take advantage of that technology. But before I answer that question, from the Nook perspective, I think it's important that when my team, when we're developing things to support the warfighter, we also have to be prepared to support the warfighter when we can't talk to them. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? You know, there's only so much incredible technology that we can use if we can't send it forward. And so while I don't ever want to stifle that inquisitive, innovative edge, I also constantly remind my team, like, how is this going to work in a comms denied environment? How are we going to look at the future and be able to operate from both places, from our wide open internet, being able to use the cloud? So, you know, that's probably the first one. Everybody's talking about the cloud, enabling cloud services, enabling easy data transfer. But what happens when that goes away and everything that we have is in the cloud? All of our, you know, processes are established. Exactly. And so that is one piece of it. But I've really pushed my folks. I will tell you that we've been waiting and waiting and waiting for the cloud to come online within Navy channels. And I've said, we can't wait anymore. Let's build things that can be transitioned to the cloud. So instead of waiting for the cloud so that we can develop the software in the cloud, we can't do that because now we're just sitting and kind of twiddling our thumbs. So let's build it, but build the back end such that it's easier to transition to the cloud. So certainly, you know, you hear the other buzzword, AI, ML, we talk about that all the time, but what does that really mean? Is it different than automation? I mean, yes, fundamentally it's different than automation, but what is it about the machine learning piece what can that bring to the nook beyond just, I really need automation, because there's a lot of things that my sailors are doing that they do not need to be spending their time on. They need to spend their capital, their human capital, and their powerful brainwaves on things that I can't teach a machine to do. You know, why we have a forecaster in the loop, why we have a human in the loop. But there are certainly things when we're looking at larger area. And when I say forecast, I'm thinking more from like a tactical decision aid perspective. If we're looking at the EM environment, I can use AIML to provide that large area map and then narrow down to an area that has a specific focus for a particular mission. So I think there's some work to be done in that. Obviously, I'm sure you are familiar with it, Dan. There's a lot of work going on as we look at the ionosphere and how are we sensing upper atmospheric conditions. We don't have a good way to do that right now. So it's one of the challenges that we've been discussing really since we went away from the balloon program and had a really funny, my former boss had sent me pictures of him launching a balloon in Antarctica recently. And he's like, look, I'm trying to get my METOC qual. You know, and that was one of the cruise lines doing that on behalf of NOAA was releasing balloons in Antarctica, which is pretty cool. They do it on every cruise. But I think, so we talked about the cloud, we talked about AIML. You know, those are certainly kind of the buzzwords. But for me, it's about trying to predict, even within the 96-hour window, what the upper atmosphere is going to look like. NEMO will eventually come online. I just came over from FinMoc today, and we talked about NEMO and the importance of NEMO, bringing those ionospheric predictions. That's going to move us forward.
Just a quick little blurb for those of listening that don't maybe haven't heard of anything other than Finding NEMO.
I don't know what the acronym stands for, but it's basically the latest and greatest ionospheric model that the Navy's working to develop. So it's introducing a lot of different aspects of the current modeling and simulation that we use for the upper atmosphere and the boundaries in the ionosphere. So that's kind of the gist of it. It's not the fish in the story, I promise.
No, it's a good question. And it is the ionospheric model that right now we don't have a capability for. There's a lot of things in Builder, which we use as our EMW tactical decision aid, that our software program, that those of us that use Builder are anxiously awaiting to be able to use some of the advanced concepts within Builder.
Mm-hmm. You know, as you're talking through that, Captain, there are two quotes that kind of quickly came to mind, and one of which I sat through an AIML summit that we had here in December, brought together all the greatest minds in the world, basically, and talked through machine learning and AI and what is it, and the director of AIML development for the Department of Defense said it's statistics at scale. And I thought that was a really resounding definition, because METOC is statistics at scale. So I think there's a huge opportunity within the community to kind of exploit that kind of concept moving forward. And the second one was, I'll throw Captain Pierman on the bus here, but he told me a long time ago, he said, you know, Dan, the information warfare community, the METOC community is the only predictive branch of that. And I think as you're talking through the different problem sets of understanding of where we need to be and when we need to be, that predictive analysis piece is huge with that. And I think there's some opportunity with the AIML kind of development to get a little bit further ahead of the curve than what we currently are. So I definitely see some potential for integration. But you're right, you know, we can't wait around for things to show up in our lap. We have to start building things now that we can integrate later.
I think the statistics at scale, I really like that comment as a way to describe AIML. And it's funny that you mentioned throwing Captain Pierman under the bus, because I was going to mention him. He has been talking a lot. I don't know if you've heard him recently speak about it. But when we talk about connectivity to the warfighter and what may or may not be available, we talk about how can I maximize the computing power that I have within the nook, but still be able to support with some kind of edge processing the warfighter. How can I send you minimal information, but you have the right data sets cached on board, mm-hmm. that you can still support, that you can successfully do your job to provide decisions based to the carrier strike group or the ARG commander?
And I think I'd just like to see the focus more on getting more further ahead of the problem. And I think there's some work to be done on how we get ahead of the problem and how we understand the problem set. So coupling those kind of thought processes, I think, is definitely the key to success moving forward.
And for those who are interested and want to go look it up, NEMO is the Navy Ionosphere Model for Operations.
And there you have it.
Have fun searching. We're coming up on the end of our time with you, ma'am. So I just wanted to ask, as someone who has benefited from your leadership, how do you describe your leadership style and how has it contributed to your success and the success of your commands?
Well, thank you. Thank you for that, Colleen. I would describe my leadership style, first of all, as compassionate. I am someone who wears my heart on my sleeve. Anybody that has worked for me or near me knows that, you know, I can't hide my emotions very well. But it's because I care deeply about what I do and the people that are doing it with me, that are working with me and working for me, that, you know, I have a great love of naval oceanography. I love what we do for the Navy. And so I feel very personally responsible for making the people that are working for me, for making their lives better, for making it easier for them to do their jobs, hopefully for allowing them to find the same passion for their job that I feel for mine. That is one thing that I would characterize it as. And then the other is empowerment. So I really try to do everything I can to empower my next level leaders so that they feel like they can run their department or their command. Being in ISIC has definitely been a unique and really incredible opportunity since I've taken command of NOOC. So whether it's a command or a department or a division, I want people to feel like they have decision space within their sphere of influence and that they can walk right or left of the line and find out where that line is. And, you know, I'll give them space to make mistakes. In my command philosophy, I talk about being excellent, but I also say that excellence is not perfection. So it's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to take risks. That's how we get better. And so that's the other piece that I really, you know, I try to make sure that I'm empowering people to take their own ownership of their sphere of influence. And that way they learn their own leadership lessons. They can come to me and ask questions or, you know, when they find that they've worked themselves into a challenging spot. But so often I find that people just amaze me. They might do it differently than I do, but that doesn't mean it's wrong or right. They can have their own way of learning how to lead.
And going full circle from that compassion and empowerment back to your experience in the BAM and the faith that you had in your forecasters, you know, we talk about how METOC, it starts with us, but that's not necessarily just the product. It's the people behind the product and their passion for what they do. Without those folks, we'd be in a world hurt.
Definitely be in a bind, for
absolutely.
Sure.
Thanks for your time, man. We definitely appreciate you sitting down with us and taking time out of your schedule while you're out here at MPS. It's always great to sit down with leadership and get you know, some education and thought process. I think every one of us in the room, and hopefully the listeners out there, all get an opportunity to benefit from that experience and learn something new. So thank you very much for taking time today to sit down with us. We very much appreciate it.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Any concluding remarks you want to add, ma'am?
No, thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening, everybody. This has been MeTalk MeTalks.
Thanks for joining us in the Trident Room. For more information about today's guests and topics, please visit the show notes online at nps.edu/Trident Room Podcast. The Trident Room Podcast has been brought to you by the Naval Postgraduate School Alumni Association and Foundation. For questions, comments, and suggestions, please email us at TridentRoomPodcastHost@nps.edu.